Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this, the 200th episode of RealityCast, I'll be interviewing Larry Finer from the Guttmacher Institute about growing inequalities in the unintended pregnancy rate. Also, Michelle Bachmann ups the ante on extremist rhetoric, and an ultrasound law is blocked in Texas. The first lawsuit over fetal pain laws has been filed.
Janie Lynn McCormick from Idaho is suing a state prosecutor because of the way that they handled her abortion. Okay, in Idaho, it's extremely difficult to get an abortion, especially if you are in the eastern portion of Idaho. There are no providers or abortion providers there, so you have to travel out of town. It takes a great deal of time and money to do that, right? And a lot of women don't have that opportunity. So she actually looked up abortion pills online with her sister, and then she took the pills and had an abortion when she was 5 to 6 months pregnant.
I'm worried that the woman isn't the most sympathetic person, but she really is in a horrible situation. She's a mother of three who lives on $200 a month, and she was basically forced into this situation because she really had no other option. Presidential primary candidates got together for yet another forum, this time hosted in South Carolina, and once again, it gave some of the candidates an opportunity to compete in a contest of who's the furthest to the right. On the issue of abortion, Michelle Bachmann turned in a solid performance as a fanatic, though she did stop short of saying she supported putting women who test positive for pregnancy in captivity to make sure that they have their babies no matter what. But she didn't stop much short of that. Her response to the question of abortion was, frankly, chilling.
I would put forward a human life amendment, and at the same time, I would do everything within my power to restrict the number of abortions that occurs in the United States.
There's a couple of versions of the human life amendment I've seen floating around, but they're all basically the same as those personhood amendments that anti-choice activists are pushing in various states. The wording defines fertilized eggs as human beings, with the hope that a woman who has one inside her, or may have had one inside her, since they can't be detected with modern scientific tools, loses her basic human rights. This is beyond just abortion, though obviously driving women who want abortion, currently over a million a year, into looking at illegal or unsafe options is bad enough as it is. But defining a fertilized egg as a person has even more widespread consequences. It would mean a ban on stem cell research and using IVF to get pregnant, for one thing. Anti-choicers also hope it would mean a ban on female-controlled contraception, such as birth control pills and IUDs, which they falsely claim cause fertilized eggs to die. This may not hold up, but absolutely, it's a danger in that very ordinary behavior from women will get criminalized. Already, the government is using the birth of stillborns to prosecute women for child abuse if they were found to use drugs during pregnancy, even if there's not a scrap of evidence linking the drug use to stillbirth. A solid percentage, around 50% of fertilized eggs, slough off on their own without attaching. Drink a beer and have a period? How do we know there isn't a corpse you created lingering on that tampon? It's a situation that's ripe for selective enforcement, which again is already going on with stillbirths, which are common, but only a handful of women are prosecuted over them because the government has something against those women. Additionally, a law like this can and probably would be used to justify restricting women's ability to eat certain foods, go certain places, and hold certain jobs, on the grounds that these things could affect fertilized eggs that may be inside them but are undetectable. But Bachmann kept going.
The Supreme Court, by a plurality of the justices, may impose their own personal morality on the rest of the nation, then we are quite literally being ruled by those individuals.
As I argued on XX Factor, she's saying up is down and black is white. She's arguing that by giving women the right to abortion, the Supreme Court imposed their morality on the nation. To which I say, how? Roe versus Wade didn't require a single woman who doesn't want an abortion to have one. What it did allow was women who want them to have them. In other words, it disallowed the government to foist personal morality on women. It did the opposite of what she's saying. Bachman is saying that your neighbor's choice to have an abortion is somehow an imposition on your freedom. That may make emotional sense to people who believe all women everywhere are their own personal property to be controlled by them, but it makes exactly no legal sense. Since when does Michelle Bachman own my uterus? And since when is my choice to do what I want with it a violation of her rights? But wait, it gets even worse.
If it meant a confrontation with the Supreme Court, are you prepared for that?
Most assuredly.
A confrontation with the court if they continue to rule that women are self-owned human beings with rights instead of reversing course and ruling that women should be forced to bear children against their will? What on earth would that mean? Does she mean something mild like when Obama criticized the Supreme Court for the Citizens United ruling? I doubt it, since this is a discussion about confrontation, not just criticism. Is she implying that a power grab or a coup is an acceptable response to the court ruling that women are full human beings with full human rights? Hard to say, but certainly I would imagine the authors of the Constitution that Bachman is always on about would probably not like her blithe dismissal of the powers they themselves gave the Supreme Court.
I'd like to welcome Lawrence Feiner to the program. Lawrence is the Director of Domestic Research for the Guttmacher Institute and one of the authors on a recent report titled Unintended Pregnancy in the United States, Incidents and Disparities 2006. The report chronicles the trends in unintended pregnancy with surprising and discouraging news about the gap between the haves and the have-nots. And Larry's here to talk about the results. Welcome to RealityCast, Larry.
Thank you very much.
So let's start with your methodology. Can you quickly describe it?
Sure. We focused on unintended pregnancy in the United States because we see this as a key measure, perhaps one of the most important measures of a population's reproductive health. The extent to which people can control their childbearing, have kids when they want to and not have kids when they don't want to is a very central reproductive health goal. So we used a number of data sets to try to assess the extent to which people are achieving this goal. The primary data set that we used is one called the National Survey of Family Growth, which surveys thousands of women and asks them about the pregnancies that they've had. And for each pregnancy, each woman who is answering indicates whether or not she intended to get pregnant at the time that she did. So these are women's own reports of whether or not their pregnancy was intended. And based on those data, and we combine that with data from the Census Bureau and a few other sources, we're able to determine the proportion of pregnancies that are unintended or unplanned, if you prefer, and also the unintended pregnancy rate, which is the number of unintended pregnancies for every 1,000 women of reproductive age.
And if you gave the statistics that you collected just a passing glance, it would seem that the U.S. unintended pregnancy rate is staying stable at like half of pregnancies.
That's right. It has been the case for some years now that about half of all pregnancies in the U.S. are unintended. And unfortunately, we haven't really made any progress in reducing that overall rate. And what's more, the stagnation in the overall rate actually masks some clear disparities in a number of demographic instances. So, for example, low-income women have much higher unintended pregnancy rates than wealthier women do. It's a very clear disparity there, and one that appears to have been increasing.
Yeah, that was what I thought was really interesting about it was, you know, all of the education and healthcare and everything else that's gone towards this problem does seem to be working on some women, but it's having the opposite effect, or not the opposite effect. You're seeing unintended pregnancy rates actually going up for lower income women, correct?
That's right. We haven't specifically looked in this particular study. We didn't specifically look at the reasons for the disparities or the increases in the disparities, but we can make some educated guesses. I think, first of all, it's important to look at these results in a broader context. The relationship between income and health is one of the longest recognized patterns in all of public health. I mean, you see this relationship in many other cases, not just within the reproductive health world. There are disparities by income and access to healthcare services and health outcomes. Women who have resources and who have stable lives generally are more able to tend to their health needs. And in this specific instance, it tends to operationalize through the fact that such women are generally more effective contraceptors. Women who have a lot of life disruptions may find it more challenging to use methods or to use them regularly. For example, a woman who has to take a pill every day, if a woman has a regular life pattern, then that maybe makes it easier for her to use such a method than a woman whose life is a little more challenging. There are also some obstacles within the reproductive health domain specifically that affect poor women more, most notably the cost of methods, specifically the cost of long-acting methods. Even when methods are covered by insurance, it's often the case that some of the most effective methods and most long-acting methods like the IUD and implant aren't always covered by insurance plans, and in some cases those methods have very high upfront costs. So in the case of a method like the IUD, even though it's a very effective and very cost-effective method in the long term, the upfront cost may be a barrier to women accessing those methods. And as a result, we're not optimizing our method mix in that sense. We're not in a situation where women are perhaps using the best method for them. They may be using some method, but they may not be optimizing their method choice.
Well, and I suppose this is where my question comes in. These things have always been true of women living under the poverty line, that they're more likely to have unstable lives, that they're more likely to have to struggle to afford contraception, and yet what was the rate change? It went up significantly for women living below the federal poverty line.
That's right. So if you look over the longer term, if you compare, say, 1994 to our most recent data, which were for 2006, the unintended pregnancy rate for poor women increased by about 50%, so it was half again as high as it was at the earlier time.
And I realize that you weren't looking into causes, but do you have any inclination as to what could have caused such a dramatic change?
Well, I mean, in addition to the kinds of things I talked about before, as the number of women who are poor increases over time, and we have seen some increases there, you have a greater number of women needing services, and that, in a lot of cases, puts a strain on providers, clinics or other groups that serve lower-income women, and these providers are already short of resources. I think it's probably a combination of several factors. It's happening at the individual level, but it's also happening at a structural level in terms of the ability of providers to meet the needs of the women that they serve.
I suppose the good news on this is that even while the rates are going up for women of low income, you did find a significant improvement in women who have more resources being able to prevent unintended pregnancy. Can you talk a little bit about that?
That's right. I mean, if you look at the United States overall compared to, say, a number of Western European countries, our unintended pregnancy rate is a lot higher. But that's not true for everybody in the U.S. Among women who are wealthier, who have more resources, who have more education, rates are quite low and in some cases similar to the rates in these Western European countries. So it shows that at least among some populations, we are able to achieve significantly lower rates. Another group where we saw improvements was teens. Particularly younger teens. The unintended pregnancy rate for teens and for younger teens in specific has been dropping and continued to drop through the most recent period that we measured. But I think we should still keep in mind the fact that among those pregnancies that do occur to teenagers, almost all of them are still unintended. And if you look at the group that is the highest risk group, the highest rates of unintended pregnancy are seen among women who are between 18 and 24. So that is really the group that is the highest risk period.
And that's, would you say it's probably in part because they're they're probably the most vulnerable. They have no parents protecting them, but they haven't really kind of come into their own yet.
Well, I think it has to do perhaps more with the fact that by that age, women are most women are sexually active, but many are not married or don't have a long-term partner. And so as a result, they are in a situation where they are perhaps more at risk of unintended pregnancy. We really see it among cohabitors, in fact. Cohabiting women have a very high unintended pregnancy rate because they're sexually active, they are partnered, and they're having sex, but maybe they're not wanting to have a child at that point or not ready to marry. And so as a result, the circumstances are ripe among that group for unintended pregnancies to occur.
And I think the one last thing that I want to kind of discuss with you is all of these things are coming up against the Affordable Health Care Act that was passed last year. Do you feel that this could have an impact on the unintended pregnancy rates, especially knowing as we do now that how much of it's coming from women of lower income levels?
I think it could. I think that in particular, the new HHS regulations, the Health and Human Services regulations that are going to mandate that all contraceptive methods be covered by insurance without any copay for the woman, I think this really could have an impact on the unintended pregnancy rate. There are, of course, a lot of factors playing into it, but there is evidence that if women have real access to the full range of methods and good information about all the methods that are available to them, that they will choose long-acting methods. We have a number of methods that are really kind of underutilized today in the U.S. A recent study in St. Louis, the CHOICE contraceptive study, in that study women were given free access to any method that they chose, and they were given full information about every method. And in that study, women were choosing highly effective long-acting methods in very high numbers. So there's a big gap between the methods that we're currently using and the effectiveness of the methods that we could be using. And I think that with the new regulations in place, it's really going to remove a very big barrier, the cost barrier, to choosing some of these more effective methods. So let's keep our eye on the statistics. Guttmacher will certainly be doing that, and we'll be monitoring what happens as these new regulations are implemented.
My guest today has been Lawrence Finer. You can read the report, Unintended Pregnancy in the United States, Incidents and Disparities 2006, at the Guttmacher website. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Lawrence.
Appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
While most of the news lately about abortion rights has been grim, I do have one good news item to report, this time out of Texas. Earlier this year, Governor Rick Perry rushed through one of the most restrictive mandatory ultrasound laws in the nation, claiming that it was an emergency provision. He did this in a state that's experiencing record drought and high unemployment, but the idea that women might be getting legal abortions without going through medically unnecessary, uncomfortable, and humiliating vaginal sonograms, accompanied by ridiculous state-scripted anti-choice lectures that make no sense, that's an emergency. Melissa Harris Perry reacted appropriately to the legislation.
Rick Perry wants to make the government so small you don't even notice it. You don't even know it's there. Government? What government? I don't see any government. It's so small. Unless you're a lady. In which case, Rick Perry wants to make government so big that it can control the pregnancy of any given woman in Texas. On nearly every other issue, Rick Perry wants government to be practically non-existent. He wants government to be nowhere near you as a citizen, not even if you want it or need it. But on this one issue, on the issue of abortion, he wants government to be right there with you, handing your doctor a script, whispering in your ear that you should be ashamed of yourself. Rick Perry wants to get all up in your uterus and take a picture.
The excuse for mandatory ultrasound laws is that they are about informed consent, i.e., anti-choicers argue that women are literally too stupid to know that an abortion will remove an embryo from their bodies. And they believe that if you show women a fuzzy picture of a minuscule batch of cells, they'll suddenly go, "Oh, you mean if I have an abortion, I won't have a baby?" and run screaming from the office. That's what antis claim anyway, but empirical evidence shows that women who look at ultrasounds don't actually decide against abortions, because women can't be that stupid. It's really impossible. Harris Perry had a clip of some of the bill authors explaining their logic. Warning, put in your mouth guard if you're a teeth grinder, since these men appear to literally believe your average woman's intelligence falls somewhere between that of a three-year-old and a kitchen sponge.
It's not so much about abortions or sonograms, but it's about the woman being fully informed.
So it's a procedure that will inform the lady,
But what this bill does would require that the sonogram be presented to the woman. She have at least 24 hours to go home, think about it, pray about it, make sure she's what she's doing.
That creepy piece of video there, the bill doesn't just require a 24-hour waiting period between the mandatory sonogram and the procedure. It also requires doctors to describe the fetus to the woman to make sure she can hear the heartbeat if there is one.
Yeah, it's truly painful listening to two very, very stupid men go on about how stupid women are, isn't it? Anyway, the reality of this bill is that it has nothing to do with informed consent, which, again, is already being provided as women actually seek out abortions to terminate pregnancies, and they aren't really going to be like, what do you mean if I do this I don't get a baby? The specifications on the heartbeat in the image actually clue you into what's going on. In order to get that sort of thing at the stage of their pregnancies and their aborting, okay, and that is very, very early, women have to do a vaginal ultrasound, which is incredibly uncomfortable and invasive. And while the doctor is doing this, the doctor has to be delivering a state-scripted lecture instead of doing what doctors usually do through miserable procedures, which is offering information and comfort. It's about punishing women who have abortions with physical and psychological abuse. You get the impression that the legislators would probably like to shove giant uncomfortable objects inside women themselves if they could get away with it. Luckily, the Let's Punish Women with Unnecessary Vaginal Penetration and Humiliation law has been stalled for now.
Well, a judge has temporarily blocked several key parts of a controversial Texas law that's aimed at discouraging women from getting abortions. Among other things, it would require several doctor's appointments and an invasive sonogram before the procedure. Under the law, we are told women who want an abortion must first look at an image of the fetus or embryo and listen to the heartbeat. The judge ruled that was unconstitutional, saying, and I'm quoting here, the act compels physicians to advance an ideological agenda with which they may not agree.
So, Texas anti-choicers have been temporarily prevented from punishing women whose sexual choices they disapprove of by shoving unwanted, unnecessary probes into their bodies. But I imagine that their desire to punish sexually active women with vaginal penetration won't be thwarted forever. Many laws allowing the physical abuse of women who have abortions under the guise of informed consent have been allowed to stand, in part because many people don't get that this has nothing to do with informed consent and everything to do with hurting women for going against the sexual rules of fundamentalist Christians. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. The damned if you do, damned if you don't edition. This conversation on Fox is possibly the most asinine thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. What do you make of this?
Well, she also says in her piece, at the end of the day, women just want to be taken care of. And you know what? After decades and decades and decades of feminists burning their bras, saying, make more money than men, do this, run over men, have sex like a man, tell your man what to do, don't let them open the door. They're not happy with the product, are you, ladies? Because a lot of them are older, they're not married, and they're not getting you-know-what.
Okay, you have the bizarre argument that feminists somehow are running over men by wanting equality, which assumes that this is a zero-sum game, and if men aren't dominating women, women must be dominating men. Actually, feminists are saying, no one dominate anyone else. But also, this whole feminists aren't getting laid and they're angry crap, I spend hours each week cataloging the way conservatives are angry because they believe feminism means women are getting laid, which they really, really hate. They want to punish us with vaginal probes, by stripping our rights, by slut-shaming us. Even in this clip, this Fox News lady is screeching that we want to have sex like men, by which she means having sex for pleasure. And so the argument is that we're unsatisfied because we're having sex for pleasure. That's really confusing, like arguing that the only way to enjoy food is to live on energy bars eaten only for survival. All this conservative arguing that up is down is just exhausting.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.